Our featured guest this morning is the youngest person ever to sail around the world solo. New Zealand-born but raised in the Netherlands, Laura Dekker was 14 when she set off and 16 when she completed her voyage. A voyage she almost didn't get to make, as authorities in her homeland, in the Netherlands, took her and her parents to court in an effort to prevent it. Laura was in fact 13 when she wanted to set off on the venture, but when social welfare in the Netherlands caught wind of her plans, they intervened, making her a ward of the state for a time. How could a 13-year-old sail around the world alone, they asked? What kind of parents would allow such a thing? Six court cases later, Laura succeeded in getting the legal go-ahead to fulfil her dream aboard her 12.3-metre ketch, Guppy. Along the way, she encountered fierce storms, almost became becalmed in the doldrums, was nearly holed by a whale and carried out countless repairs to her boat. There were also moments of unadulterated joy outlined in her book that we're about to discuss. She also decided that she would never live in the Netherlands again and has chosen to base herself in New Zealand. She lives on Guppy in Whangarei Harbour. Laura's written a book about her journey. It's called One Girl, One Dream. She's with me in the Auckland studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
And that was a dream that started very young. How old were you when you decided that you would sail around the world alone?
Well, I was about 8 when this dream kind of came up. But I just knew that one time in my life I wanted to sail around the world at some stage. I hadn't thought of the fact that I wanted to do it alone or at a young age. I just wanted to do it. And so from when I was 8, I started preparing this trip, just learning everything about it. And probably by the time I was 10, I had everything written out. I knew where I wanted to go, all the harbors and the distances and everything. Yeah, when I was 13, I felt like I was ready for it, and I prepared everything, and I just wanted to leave. I didn't see a point why not.
You were very inspired by another sailor, Tanya Ibi.
Yes.
I think by 10, you'd read her book.
Yep.
And that was another step along the way in forming the plan and firming up the plan.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, she was 18 when she sailed around the world on her own. And she didn't even know how to sail before she left off. So that was a very interesting story. But I already had the idea. My parents sailed around the world for 7 years. And just all these things together made me really want to do that.
You were ready by 13. In your mind, you were ready by 13
to
do it. You wanted to do it.
I was ready.
And the reason you were ready in part was because there's an absolutely wonderful picture. I love this in the book. On your homemade yacht. How old were you there, Laura?
A 6.
Where was this?
That's in Holland, and my dad was actually building a boat, so I got inspired to build my own little
boat.
You
built that yourself.
So yeah,
we've got one slab of wood, we've got a couple of small slabs of wood on top of that for your seat, and we've got a little homemade sail here. And that's all done by you at 6.
Yeah, I did my first river crossings with that. It was quite exciting.
Why was the sea and yachting itself so much a part of your life at this young age? I mean, it's not unusual for children to sail, of course it's not, but for you it was almost a way of life. And what was life like at that very young age that this was so? How would you describe it?
Good question. I don't know. I started sailing when I was 6, first in net and then an optimist, and doing competitive racing when I was a little bit older. I just really loved being out there. I loved just using the wind and using the nature to go somewhere where you want to go, and you're in complete control of your boat. At least if you know your boat and you know how to sail, and you are in complete control of your boat, it's a very cool feeling.
And that is something that you had by 13, and that's perhaps something, along with other things, that others didn't understand. Everyone said, how can you know enough to sail by yourself, to overcome all the problems and all the challenges by 13. But it starts right back here, as a 6-year-old, on these little slabs of wood.
Well, I've only lived for 1 year in a house my entire life. I've always lived on a boat, so sailing is one of... Yeah, I just am very comfortable being on boats and around water.
And being alone, and I'm wary of saying that, because straight away people think, if you're going to do this, you must be some kind of a loner. But this book outlines an absolutely endless number of social interactions and friendships with all sorts of people.
Yeah, it's one of the things I was very interested in for this trip, was seeing other cultures, like actually going to islands and meeting people and seeing how they lived compared to where I grew up in Holland. And that's one of the reasons why I didn't sail nonstop. I would see enough water along the way anyway. So, yeah, I was just very interested in seeing other cultures. And I met a lot of people, a lot of friends I made along the way. And it was quite cool.
But alongside that, there are the long hours and days and nights alone. Mm-hmm. And you revel in those. What is the experience, whether it was as a kid or whether it was on this journey, of you and nature and not much else around? What is it as an experience for you?
Well, I think at that age it was nice to be alone out at sea, because I did so much stuff while I was on land, and I met so many people, and I was so busy exploring that being out at sea and actually thinking about all the experiences I had made was a really cool thing. You are forced to just sit down, and there's lots of time to think. And so I would actually just sit there and think about all the things I had experienced. And that was a really cool thing. I wasn't very lonely out there. I was quite happy to just be going for my dream, to just be out there. It was very beautiful.
But there's a lot of reflection on all aspects of life when you're out in that kind of environment.
Yes, certainly.
Is it a special place to be in some ways? Is it somewhere you've always like to be, in that place in your own mind? Like there's the physical world, the physical environment you're in sailing, but there is also the internal world that it somehow opens up or makes possible.
Yeah, definitely. It's a cool thing because you're out there and it's a very untouched place. There's just nature, there's the waves and the wind, and then you are there in your little boat, but you're nothing. You're like, the boat is called Guppy because you're even smaller than a guppy when you're out at sea. You're just nothing, and it's very cool to be there using these strong elements around you to go somewhere where you want to go. But also, just you're really just there with the elements. There's nothing else. I didn't have a whole lot of communication things on the boat. I could talk to other sailors if I was in the right channel, the right time. but nothing else, no internet or phone or things like that. So it's just me on the boat. And that was a very, very peaceful thing. And I really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed being there.
There's other particular challenges to sailing and sailing alone. Sailing full stop, actually, which is fixing things when things go wrong.
Yeah.
You cannot be a person who just goes down to the local mechanic. And again, how did you learn over those years from when you began sailing to when you believed at 13 you were good to go? How did you learn to deal with all the challenges, and perhaps explain some of the challenges that came up along the way, things that broke? There was a time when the boat just came to a sudden halt and you knew that something was wrong. I think you got caught up with a whole lot of buoys at one point and nets and things, and another occasion where you knew something had gone wrong down by the rudder, some kind of, you know, automotive part needed fixing. So was that just something that you learned along the way as a child by doing so much sailing?
Yeah, my dad is, he's a boat builder, and he was building a boat at the time. So I learned a whole lot from my dad, like helping him on the boat, but I was also fixing boats myself. I had boats and I needed to keep them maintained. So I already learned a whole lot before I actually left, and I knew enough to fix things when they would break down. But then I probably learned even double from what I knew before on the trip itself.
You just doing it. You have to know the principles, and then you have to problem solve new problems.
Exactly. Yeah, if you know the beginning, and then you just start doing it and you learn a whole lot more. But yeah, things did break off. I had my steering wheel fall off at some stage. It's not very practical. I had the rudder shaft got rusted and just got stuck, so I couldn't even move the rudder. I had sails rip, so I'd have to stitch them along the way. And it's a boat. Things will break if you use it, and there's nobody out there to help you, so you just gotta go and fix it.
You stay calm when these things happen. You just have to have the mind that there's a problem, there must be a solution.
You have to stay calm. That's the thing. Especially if you're out there alone, if you start freaking out, things will go wrong. And so that's probably the most important thing, that you are able to keep your mind controlled, to think, okay, hang on, what do I need to do next, rather than start freaking out.
Another enormous challenge is the sleep patterns, because you've regularly described going 34, 36 hours without sleep, where you, sometimes that was for social reasons, I should point out, when you were on land. but when you are on watch out there, particularly you've got a bit of equipment that gives you warning out in deep sea if something is approaching, but close to land you must be awake because there's so much risk of traffic or reefs or other things. So what were the sleep patterns like? What was the longest you could get to sleep?
Yeah, it's interesting. The land is actually the most dangerous part for a boat. And so arriving somewhere, being close to land, was most dangerous parts and most difficult parts. And out at sea, I could maximum sleep for about an hour. So the radar would keep watch, but it's not, you can't completely trust it. And so, I just slept for about an hour and then woke up and looked if there were other ships and... if I was still going in the right direction, everything was still good.
So these are all the things that someone needs to do this. And we get to this question of whether a 13-year-old was ready to do it. And I know this is, even now, and you return to it over and over again in the book, actually, because the book is, in many ways, records your journal keeping and your diary keeping. So we're on this journey in some ways with you. And time again, you would go back to a year that, there's only one word for it, was profoundly traumatic for you.
Yeah, definitely. It was more difficult than the actual sailing.
Your situation at the time was your parents had separated. And I know your mum and her new partner had reservations, great reservations about the trip initially. Later on, you described the contact you're having with her and her thinking had changed. But she had reservations. Had been living for quite some time with your dad. And clearly, it's a very close relationship you have there. So this decision gets made that you want to go. And what happened that began to interfere with that plan? Like, was it when authorities first caught wind of this that all of a sudden all hell breaks loose?
I was 13, and so I needed to do schooling. And I wanted to do homeschooling, but you need to go to a person to ask permission for this. And the person that we went to, we had to explain why I wanted to do homeschooling. And so she just thought that we were completely insane, that my parents were insane, that I was insane. And she kind of forwarded it to childcare in Holland. And they just blew it up in the media in a very bad way, which is why there were a lot of articles that just did not make any sense or that untrue, because they put it out there.
Do you believe it's a deliberate campaign of them to use media? You sort of hinted that in the book.
I do think that. I'm actually quite sure of it, because there's in childcare in Holland, if something happens, then and you report it, then the people get on a wait list, and this wait list is huge, and it takes about 2 years before they actually go to the case after you've reported it.
Is it an individual, like a citizen, who reports it?
Exactly.
So if they put the story out in the media, then someone reacts and makes a complaint or raises a concern, and then you're into the system.
So the thing is, it was an individual as well who reported my case. And so normally I should have gotten on this wait list, and it would have taken 2 years before they would look at the case. But instead, the next day, it was all out in the media, which is another very weird thing, because normally they wouldn't do that. So I think they don't have a very good reputation. So I think they just wanted to put this out there, as in, oh, these people are completely insane. We will stop them. Look how good we are that we stopped these insane people. And I think that's the main reason why they started putting it out in the media.
It went as far as you being made a ward of the state at one point? It went as far as you being made a ward of a state at one point?
Yeah. They took the responsibility completely from my parents. So somebody else had the responsibility over me. We went through 8 court cases over 10 months. And we actually did have to go through tests to check if we were not insane. They turned out fine, I can assure you.
They gave you psychological tests?
They did, yes. But that all turned out fine, and then they said it was dangerous, and they came up with a lot of other things. But it was quite a media fight, really, because they put things out there that weren't true, and so it was very difficult to kind of go against that.
You also allude to the fact that you believe the state's spying agencies were spying on
you? Oh, yeah, no, definitely.
How do you know that?
Well, they said things and they knew things that they would only know if they read my emails or if they would have listened to phone conversations. There would be no other way. And so I'm very sure that they did that.
Why did you keep going? And why did your parents keep going? Was one of them more inclined to keep going than the other, by the way? Was it your dad who was very much standing side by side and saying, no, Laura's going to do this?
It was my decision, and my dad went along with me. Mm. I said, I really want to do this, and so he said, okay, I will help you. He would definitely didn't push me in any way. One of the reasons why I was just very determined I wanted to do this trip, and if I would give up, they would put me... they would take the responsibility for my parents, and I would be sitting, or probably even living... away from my parents until I was 18. So that's already a pretty horrible thing to look at.
So you were already so deep into it that you believed you had to keep going to win the case.
Yeah, because otherwise I would just lose a couple of years of my life. So that was one of the reasons why I wanted to keep going, and I just really wanted to achieve this goal. Another reason was the way childcare worked in Holland was just not correct. And I did a lot of research on them, and there actually is people working there who have no education, they have no kids, they don't know anything. They are kind of like the rejects of the society, and they work with childcare. And I was like, well, that can't be real. They shouldn't be working there.
That's a big burden on a young person's shoulders.
Well, okay, but then I got a lot of people emailing me who had... also cases that were just absurd, and they just got handled wrong. And because it wasn't just my case that was completely absurd, there were a lot of people that had cases that just should be handled differently. And so I wanted to win this fight and hopefully change something, and I'm very happy that things did change.
You write in the book that people just underestimate children and what children are capable of, and I'm hearing now it's not just the ability to sail around the world, but it's the ability to hold very strong, passionate views and to fight for them.
Yeah.
And it's a big part of your story, isn't it? Mm. That perhaps what you're describing as the welfare system in the Netherlands might be a reasonably extreme example.
Yeah.
But that societies in many of these countries just put constraints around what children can do. That are wrong.
Yeah, and it's not the children's fault. It's the parents and the society that tell the children that they need to be a certain age until they are capable of doing something, which everybody is different. I'm not saying that every 14-year-old kid can sail around the world. Certainly not. My sister is 16 now, and I don't think my parents would let her sail around the world. She's very capable in other things. She's in the circus and an acrobat, but not a sailor. So everybody is different. But children have a very an interesting mind. They think very differently, and with that, they can do quite amazing things that I think adults have kind of lost. And I think parents and adults in general should give children more opportunities. Saying that my dad did know me very well. He knew what I was capable of because he was with me all the time. He taught me everything. He went sailing with me. He knew what I was capable of. And so that's probably why he was pretty comfortable letting me go, because he knew I would handle it all right. Well, there's probably a lot of parents who don't really know what their kids are capable of, and then it's much more scary to let them do it. So
you don't have a problem with the state or someone somewhere having to get questions answered. You just think in your case, you answered all the questions and there was still this determination to stop you.
Yeah, the people were... I don't think it was really about my case. It became much bigger than me just wanting to sail around the world.
Before we set sail on this journey, because we must... Do you have a sense, I mean, you and I were talking just before we flicked the mic on, I've talked to you about people I've interviewed who got out of the education system, young ages, and you gave me a different name actually, but I've interviewed a guy in the States who just started his own online school because the education system was not working for him. He was like 12 or 13 or whatever. And so there's this whole question of whether we do straitjacket young people, instead of having more alternatives for their uniqueness and their unique abilities, to be given free rein. But if you hadn't been able to do this trip, if the authorities had won, do you have a sense of what you'd be like now, what it would have meant for you?
I don't think I would have given up. I would have probably just kept fighting.
You tried just to bolt at one point. You tried just to sail and got as far as... Which island did you get to? When you,
I
not
flew,
even your dad knew you'd gone.
I flew to St. Martin, yeah. Yes. I took the train to Paris and then left off because I didn't know I had a New Zealand passport. Mm. And so normally if you are doing court cases and stuff, you're not allowed to leave the country. So I couldn't use my Dutch passport. And so I used a New Zealand one and flew to St. Martin and actually tried to buy a boat there and sail from there. But that took about a week until the police came and picked me up again.
So what you're saying is you believe one way or another, however, you would have won this. You can't conceive now of having gone these years and not having done this.
No, I would have definitely kept fighting. Yeah.
Laura Decker is my guest. We're discussing her book, One Girl, One Dream. It's 28 minutes past 10 on 9 to noon. So even when you set sail off, the first segment is with your dad, because I think it was in Dutch territorial waters and you had to be accompanied.
Yes.
And right up to the point when you leave him and you go onto the next island, you're almost waiting and anticipating the authorities to sort of turn up again. And is there a moment when you finally realise this is happening, no one can stop it now, and I'm sailing my dream? When was that moment?
When I finished.
Really? You carried that worry with you the whole time?
Yes, I did. I did. Because the case hadn't really finished. They had given the responsibility back to my parents, and that's all that they did. And so right after they had given the responsibility back to my parents, I left. But I was still worried that if I would go back to Holland, they could continue. They could go higher up and keep going. And I was worried that they would do that because they were still writing my dad and my lawyer emails and giving them a hard time. So it was, I was worried about that all the time. They did try to kind of not involve me in it too much so I would enjoy my trip. But it was a worry.
Where did you believe then you did begin enjoying it? When were those moments where you talk about the rhythm? I love the way you talk about the rhythm you get into sailing. You go on land and sort of lose it and get it back out there and have a few moments of loneliness or whatever, and then you'd be back in the rhythm. When did you first feel that?
I think I really started getting into it going towards the Caribbean. The first trip was quite exciting and then a lot of feelings and things happening. And then the second trip, of course, as well, as getting to know the boat and how everything works. But then after the first crossing, it was, I really started to understand the boat better and understand the sailing and the feeling. So that it kept growing over time. It just kept getting better.
Guppy, I love the way you talk about Guppy. It's almost as if she's a person.
Yeah. Yeah, she does almost feel like that. Well, without Guppy, I wouldn't have been able to do it, and Guppy can't do it without me, so we're really together on that. And
is that part of the psychology, that you have to feel that in sync with the boat that you're sailing, that it's almost like a person?
I guess it really helps if you're really one with the boat. I would sleep at night, and the sounds of the boat, the waves, the angle that they get onto the boat, and you hear them. And if the angle changes, it's a different sound. And I will wake up knowing that we are on a different course or that the wind changed. Just because I got to know the sounds of the boat so well. Even sometimes something would break or change in the sails. And I would be sleeping. And in my sleep, I would find out what that was and wake up knowing what was wrong.
You'd problem solve in your sleep.
Yeah. In my sleep, and then walk there, and then start waking up and thinking, oh, what am I doing out here? And I just knew what was going on I just had kind of heard that in my sleep. You get really close with the boat, and you have to. I think it really helps.
What were some of the most memorable places you'd stop? I think it was in the Caribbean. You describe a fairly laid-back island. I can't remember which one.
There's a few laid-back islands.
The perfume of marijuana was fairly intense, and what I seem to remember.
In like the
all the sort of cliches we have are memorable. But on this journey, you're going into so many different places, so many different societies and cultures. And, and are there some that particularly stood out where you felt particularly welcome or you felt like you really saw or experienced something new?
I loved French Polynesia. I loved the islands where there was no airport, where you can just go with a boat. And people really were quite untouched. They really hadn't lost much of their culture. And I mostly found that in the Pacific Islands and French Polynesia, some islands. And that was very cool. The people are very welcoming, very friendly, and they have their really own culture, which was very interesting. And they were happy showing me around as well, even though I didn't speak their language most of the time.
There were amazing experiences with other yachties that you met, and it's something else that's evident, is that you had a double-edged sword. You were making this sailing, you were trying to become the first in the world to do it, so there's all the publicity attached with it, but equally that publicity would never leave you alone. Wherever you went, someone would call out, or someone would have heard that you were coming, camera crews would turn up. And you seem to manage that pretty well. Times you got fed up with it, but did you accept that it was part of the deal?
I didn't for a really long time. I was I was quite angry with it for a long time because it was my trip and I wanted to keep it my trip, which is also a reason why I wasn't too fond of having sponsors. And I was much more happy in rather having less equipment on the boat and and not as good equipment, rather than having sponsors and having this trip, having to share it with somebody who would change it into a different trip. Definitely, I wanted to keep it my own. So in the beginning, I was not happy with media, definitely not. And over time, I kind of learned how to deal with them and to just say, okay, look,
media conferences is how you deal with them.
Yes.
You did that at one point.
I did, in one
room, do what you want to do and
exactly,
and go
because
away.
Otherwise it just goes insane. Mm. So, but I had to just learn it by doing it. Mm. Yeah. So.
But a lot of the people you met along the way, there was one couple, was it the Canadian couple, who really became friends, and you sailed with
American couple
for quite some time, and you could almost feel the sense of loss when they headed in a different direction.
Yeah, totally. Well, there's a lot of people who are in that same route or sometimes make the same passage as you, and this was an older couple on a catamaran. I sailed with them through the Panama Canal. Well, they were on their boat, I was on my boat, so they just kind of sailed alongside me, but it was quite nice to share the experiences with other people doing the same trips, and we just headed off in different directions at some stage. But it's always sad because if you make good friends and you leave them, it's never nice.
The Panama Canal is always seen as such a risky, dangerous place for all sorts of reasons. You sort of breeze through it, but you seem reasonably familiar with the lock system because you have that in the Netherlands also.
Yeah, we have we don't have such big lock systems, but there is a lot of locks, and I went through them many, many, many times. So
it was just another passage.
Yeah.
And all
kind
the
of
worries that people have about pirates and warnings about pirates, you never really let that enter your head.
Well, it is a danger, especially in the Red Sea. Mm. There's many of them, which is why I didn't go through the Red Sea. And then around Indonesia and this area, there's a lot of fishermen who have piracy as their side job. But I didn't encounter any, or not really, problems with it.
So again, it's something you planned around to some extent.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it is a serious problem.
What was the toughest sailing? What was the bit that really tested you and Guppy to either of your limits?
Probably the Indian Ocean and going around South Africa. I sailed from Australia straight to South Africa, which is about 6,000 miles, and it took me 48 days, starting out with 2 weeks of no wind, and then a storm, and then no wind again, and then a storm again. And it was the toughest sailing part, for sure, but mentally it was one of the nicest parts, because I really felt that connection with the nature around me, and with Guppy, and just being there. So sailing-wise, it was tough, but I really found something out there that I had been looking for, just that peace in sailing.
How did it end? On any of these great ventures, we have to ask, when you achieve it, what is the mix of emotions, I imagine, that you felt? Can you recall for us that last day and completing this magnificent achievement?
It didn't really feel for me as an end of anything. I think this beginning and end part is more for my friends and the people around it, because St. Martin is where my lines cross. But I started out in Europe, and after my trip, I kept sailing. So for me, that was just another stop. It wasn't really the end of anything.
And you weren't surprised you completed it? It wasn't like there was this sense of relief or thrill,
not,
because you knew you
not
would?
Not at all, no. Yeah. I was relieved that, you know, people couldn't tell me anymore that it was gonna... that I wasn't going to make it and that it was crazy. I'd proven I could do it. So there was that relief.
Was something off your back, a weight off your back in
certainly,
some ways?
Certainly, certainly. And it was kind of... I felt like it was the end of a dream and in the beginning of my life, really. Because I'd just been living on my own, and then that moment I was free to go wherever. But it was another stop. I kept sailing to New Zealand after that, which is another half time around the world. So
it's interesting you say it was the end of a dream and beginning of your life, because I'm wondering sometimes, when you complete such a large dream at such a young age, are you left in some ways with a void? Or, and what, it was what I'm hearing from you, that actually you're embracing whatever life is going to be now, empowered by having done this thing. How are you viewing it? How are you feeling it?
Well, yeah, I've been, since I was 8, I had been working towards this dream. So, yeah, when it was over, I was just like, okay, so I've done that, so I can start living now. There's so many opportunities, so many things to do, and I was very happy I did it. I certainly learned a lot of things from it, and it's like a good base to go further on, and I hope to I will definitely keep sailing, and I hope to go on many more adventures.
Do you have a sense of what the next few years will bring? Obviously at the moment you're still, as you say, you're still going, you're promoting the book now, you're talking about this. I don't know, is someone going to make a film about this?
There's a documentary out called Maiden Trip. So, that happened. I'm travelling overland a lot as well, but no, I don't really tend to plan ahead a lot.
Because so you're still what, 18?
I'm 19.
19, forgive me. So there's a tremendous life force here, and there has been since the age of 6, that's so obvious. But there's no plan and there's no concern over how it's going to...
No, I'll just see what happens.
Do you still carry the scars of that year that your family went through?
It's definitely getting better, but during my trip, I was, it was definitely something that was quite tough to all think about and go through, but it's a lot better now. I'm far away from it. I'm happy that I live here now and... doing the things that I love to do. It's very nice.
Thank you for coming in. Really appreciate it. Laura Decker. Thank you. And the book is One Girl, One Dream. It is published by... I always mark this up.
HarperCollins.
HarperCollins. Thank you very, very much. See? Every problem has a solution, Laura.